Hey everybody, welcome to TCP Talks with Jonathan Baker and Justin Broadley from the Cloud Pod. In this series, we're bringing you interviews with the best and brightest leaders and heroes from the tech and cloud industry.
Good afternoon, listeners. We have another fantastic TCP Talks here for you. And joining me is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Cohn, who this is your first time here on TCP Talks, is it not?
It is my first time. I'm slightly stressed out, but it'll be fun to do.
Yeah. Well, hopefully your Northeastern accent doesn't throw off our listeners who are used to Jonathan's docile British tones. We wanted to make sure we got this interview in while Jonathan's out. And so we're happy that you could join us.
Yeah, I was thinking about trying to do the British accent, but it was going to end poorly for everyone involved.
Well, great. Well, we're going to be talking here in a couple of minutes to Chris Opat from Backblaze. How much do you know, Matt, about Backblaze?
I mean, I've definitely looked at the reports over the years, the hard drive reports, which I'm sure, you know, is way a lot of people know them. I've looked at using them for my own like little side projects here and there, but not nearly enough. So that's why I'm excited to get on the call with Chris.
All right. Awesome. Well, let me do a brief introduction here. First of all, I am admittedly a huge fan of Backblaze. Not only am I a customer for multiple computers on my house, I also hold a little bit of stock that I've had since the IPO. And, you know, I've been following the company the same way you have, Matt, you know, seeing the hard drive reports. I was very intrigued by the big red box that they used to build. And originally, for those who don't know, Backblaze started as a consumer-facing backup company and was well-known for their guerrilla storage purchasing across the Bay Area as they snapped up external and internal hard drives from local Best Buys, Fry's Electronics, and other retailers to build those custom red boxes. But in September 2015, they jumped into the cloud storage space with the launch of B2, which was basically one quarter of the cost of S3 at the time and a significantly better cost per gigabyte for downloads. By the time that was released in public in December, they had over 30,000 users all tied to the simple philosophy, what if we made storage so cheap it was almost free? And so to talk about that and more, I'm excited to introduce our guest, Chris Opat, SVP of Cloud Operations at Backblaze, as today's guest. Chris, would you like to tell us a bit more about yourself and your role at Backblaze?
Absolutely. First of all, Justin, your preparedness is impressive. You've got the entire encyclopedic history of the company there in a couple of minutes. Very impressive. And Matt, nice to be with you as well. I'm super happy to be part of the team here at Backblaze. I joined the company barely 2 years ago. Time flies when you're having fun. It's a really wonderful time to be in the market we're in. The growth we're seeing over the last 2 years is phenomenal. The change in the customer cohort, which maybe we'll spend some time talking about here, is bringing all kinds of exciting workloads to the cloud storage segment of everyone's app stacks. And I think that our best years have yet to be had. So thanks for being a shareholder, and we're going to not let you down.
Well, I appreciate that. It's definitely been fun to listen to the earnings calls and see the transition. But you mentioned you've only been there for about 2 years. And so, what resonated about Backblaze and excited you about the opportunity to join them when you did?
Good question. So I spent a number of years working in the private equity industry doing portfolio companies. And it's a very powerful way to become very adept at what you do because there's a lot of expectation and there's a short time frame to work within. And after doing about three or four at-bats of that, I kind of started to reconcile, what did I want to do next? And I came to realize that my happiest years were working for a publicly traded company, but I also wanted to intersect that with the agility and the fun of working for a smaller startup. And so Backblaze is a perfect union of that, right? Where you have a couple hundred people, a public company, high ambitions, a great board that's put very, very achievable challenges in front of us. And the other aspect I love about the company, and this is a theme that consistently goes throughout my career, is that we are the David taking on the Goliath. And I thrive in those kinds of environments. Nothing makes me happier than to watch a customer choose us over the incumbent competitors and have an exceptionally good experience. That feels so rewarding, right? Because there's a lot of companies out there that try to punch above their weight. Some do, some don't. But here we're knocking up wins on the board every week. And that feels terrific. it's easy to work for the incumbents and kind of win all the time. It feels so much better when you do it as the upstart that people don't see coming.
So obviously, you know, there's large competitors out there, you know, with the storage space, AWS, GCP, and Azure. You know, it's what we talk about weekly here on the Cloud Pod.
Yep.
But what are some of the challenges and opportunities that resonate with you about, you know, B2 and Backblaze customers over the traditional object storage of those hyperscalers?
So first thing, we are a different type of a partner than most people's experience with the hyperscalers. Hyperscalers are they're fine to work with, but they're not going to give you the level of attention that you're going to get from us. You probably can talk to people at Backblaze that are very influential, that are shaping the strategy of what we do. There's every opportunity to help us guide part of our product strategy. There's a high level of touch here. You know, we care about all of our customers and we have a lot of heavy dialogue with them, you know, on a recurring basis to say, how are you doing? Where are you going? What can we do to help you get there? You know, and a typical experience with a hyperscaler is not like that unless you're at a certain buying cohort, right? There's a certain level of buyers that get that and everybody else, you know, kind of pays through the portal. Obviously, you know, we bring value. We bring value in a number of ways. We have a performant product that, and we measure canary performance from our product against the competitors, you know, on a very routine basis. And the data supports that we outperform the competition in a number of key KPIs. And we do it at a price point that the others can't touch. Okay. And that's been part of the company's DNA since the onset. You know, as Justin talked about, the founders building pods in an apartment in the Bay Area built out of consumer level gear, right? Hand bending the metal, buying drives from Best Buy, all that stuff. You know, that this is the company's DNA, is doing impossible things and passing that on to the customer. You know, the other piece I touch on is our approach to making it easy for customers to use their data in the way they want. Everybody who uses a hyperscaler is very familiar with the taxation of egress fees. It's not a trivial subject. We have addressed it with a lot of customers. We come with a very aggressive no egress policy, and our customers definitely are attracted to that. If you don't know what you're doing with a hyperscaler, egress fees can quickly sour your experience. They can drain your budget. They can do a lot of things that you may not see coming. But we have a very upfront and honest and transparent pricing model, simple flat rate pricing on a per terabyte basis globally, plus, you know, easy paths to get your data in and out.
It's interesting. I imagine that most of your customers probably are on a hyperscaler already, or building on a hyperscaler, or looking to do that. How do you typically go in and sell to those customers and say, hey, you should be using B2? You know, egress fees is a great, you know, reason, especially if you have a lot of outbound traffic. But what other things do you typically talk to with customers who are thinking about a hybrid cloud architecture like this?
The DNA of the company, as I said, is built upon bringing that value, right? So we do have a strong reputation for being a price leader. We bring value with technology and other enabling features in the offering. But more often than not, right, what we're helping customers do is layer down the cost of the multiple tiers of S3 and the Byzantine billing that you've got to wade through and the policies and the rules and all that. You know, we bring one tier of storage. It's hot all the time. And people like the elegance and simplicity of that. We also bring very strong ability to be a direct drop-in for an established app architecture. We have fully S3 compatible APIs in addition to our own B2 APIs, which bring a different level of features. So the transition is typically easy at an application coding level. And we've got partners on the back end that can help immensely with the data migration to get your data out of wherever it is and over to us, or you know, come up with a migration strategy in general. So to be fair, customers want to see us come to the table with a conversation about how we're going to save them money, right? We have one customer that we have some public information about in a white paper that we saved them hundreds of thousands of dollars on egress fees in the first year of their operating with us. When you match that with a product that is as performant as S3 or better in many cases, it's a pretty powerful story.
Do you think the recent, you know, announcements from Google and Amazon about reducing or eliminating egress fees is a great benefit to you, or do you think it's a risk?
So that's a great topic. I've had so many conversations about this since that that was the fad. When was it, 9 months ago, or whenever, when they started all doing that? And the devil's in the details with that, right? And a lot of people realize this before they sign the paperwork. But the way you get the free egress is if you discontinue all of your services at an account level. It's not to say, I just want to take my data off of S3, we'll keep EC2, or we'll keep other components, right? The only way that they honor the free egress for repatriating your data is if you cancel all the services. And the cancellation timeframe, I have to refresh my memory on this, it's something pretty brisk. It's like 90 days or something. So exfiltrating all of your data, migrating your app stack, doing all of that in 90 days is it's achievable, but it's not achievable for everyone. But what they put out there is, you know, we're not the walled garden you think we are. If you want to take your data, you can have it. We don't charge egress fees. But what's in the fine print is, and you got to cancel everything you ever did with us. That's not an easy thing for people to take, right? It's very hard to replace every component of some of these developed, you know, fully orchestrated stacks that people build in the hyperscalers. And, you know, credit where due, it's a nice place to build an application, right? But those egress fees are still going to be there.
Let's get a little bit into the weeds here, because as an old school infrastructure guy myself, I've managed hundreds of petabytes of scale, but you guys are doing significantly larger amounts of scale than I've ever had to think about. What are some of the operational challenges that you come into thinking about, and how do you deal with capacity planning in something like this, especially, you know, your sales-driven organization, just like many other SaaS companies? You know, it's very difficult to predict, and so I'm curious about how capacity planning works in something like this.
It's a full-time science, to be fair. We've got people who are fully dedicated to this, and that's what they do all day. And that's something that we take great pride in, because they do such a good job. But I'll address your point, you know, more clearly. The company was built on the shoulders of an application that, as you mentioned, is there to protect people's personal and computer data. And on a scheduled basis, it would interrogate your system and say, new files, yep, send them up. Make sure that we've got all the pictures of your family and your cats and everything else. And the demand signal around that type of a use profile is fairly tame and predictable. Home users aren't typically ripping out drives and putting in larger ones, or seeing large quantities of data move up to cloud storage. So for the hundreds of thousands of customers that we have on the B1 product, the demand signal is fairly forecastable, because the growth curve is a fairly straight line. Not a lot of variance in that. Enter the B2 user cohort into the frame, and now things get quite a bit more dynamic, right? We have customers who are uploading content rapidly, churning content rapidly. We have a new subset of AI-based customers who are moving huge quantities of data to us for inference modeling. We've got private connections to some customers where we're serializing 400 gigabits per second line rate to them, so that they can very, very rapidly move libraries of data to tightly schedule back to back with perhaps maybe a GPU farm instance that they've got booked. Now, managing the forecast around that takes a little bit more calculus. We do nightly linear regressions on the installed environment. We're always watching the what we call the triangle of tension, where you've got reads, writes, and deletes on a drive that are trying to make sure that they can coexist. If you exhaust IOPS, somebody's experience is going to be compromised. Not sure whose, but you've got to make sure that you can live, all those can live in peace and harmony with each other. So, we're always weighing the benefits of larger drives versus maybe not being the absolute largest drive, match that with the workloads, so that there's never a problem where we've got IOPS starvation on the platform, and we always have that horizontal scale. But you know, the way that this customer cohort has changed over the last 2 years is nothing short of astonishing. We have serviced a lot of large customers in B2 for years, and we love them and we're very thankful for them. But in the last 2 years, the onset of this, we kind of bucket them into this AI kind of metaphor, even though that's a little bit of a, you know, tired trope in the world these days. But the way that they approach the interest in mixing storage with the network throughput, the peering, where the data goes, is presenting an entire new set of challenges. And it does require, like I said, daily, nightly, these numbers are recalculated and they're looked at. We stay ahead of the curve through a very set of well-developed relationships with OEMs. Some time ago, we stopped bending our own metal and building our own pods. That gets to be a bit tricky when you've got, 310,000 drives in production. So we have key partnerships with suppliers. They see our annual forecast. They understand when we're going to be scheduling what orders we want on a relatively quarterly basis. And if that number needs to change, those partners are happy to work with us. We have been accelerating orders quite a lot because of the success we've had in certain sales demographics in certain markets. And our OEMs are happy to say, not a problem. The gear gets delivered on or ahead of schedule. But the fact that we have people on this effort full time is the key. I can't emphasize that enough, right? There's never a day when there's not a solid group of people that are always looking at what the patterns are in our clusters and making sure that we're staying a couple of steps ahead of where our users are going.
As all these different teams that you keep talking about and companies are starting to leverage your platform, are you seeing like any common mistakes, with how they interact with the object-based storage and everything else that you guys provide versus the hyperscalers?
Yeah. One of the most problems, I should say, that we see is where a customer doesn't fully see where they're headed with hyperscaler storage consumption and the incrementing cost and the very real challenge of migrating or exfiltrating that data. We recently onboarded a very, very large customer who had a massive library of data in excess of 30 petabytes of data. And getting that out of a hyperscaler is hard rock mining. There's very, very easy ways around that saves, any real cost over just, straight egress. There's a lot of trickery you can do to try to get that price down a bit, but there's no getting around it, right? So, that is one of the most common problems that we seek to solve for customers is that, when you come to us, you will have a performant experience and the run rate recurring costs will be substantially down. But we've got to be really smart about the migration strategy on how you get from place to place. One of the other challenges that we see customers not take mind of is their own workload profile and how that may or may not integrate well with other providers. Every storage provider has some methodology to protect the system with rate limits. We're no different. We have sensible guardrails that we make sure, we control traffic in a smart way. However, we bring the ability to open those rate limits up to extremely high speeds, right? And, we've recently launched the B2 Overdrive product, and we've got multiple customers on that offering now, as I said before, serializing 400 gigabits a second. Most of the competition will not entertain giving you that kind of network bandwidth. They just flat out won't. It's not even on the board. But for a certain subset of customers, that's a necessity. They've got to be able to move data rapidly. They've got to be able to feed compute farms. So if you don't think that through and you end up against the brick wall where it takes months to move a library of data versus hours with us, that can really change the success of your business. I think that's one of the prime reasons we see this very developed funnel of customers in that market segment coming to us.
Well, let's jump over to cost optimization. I know that's an area of big focus for you. When you're thinking about a SAN NAS migration to object storage, it's easy to get distracted by the cost per gigabyte. What other areas do you think about when we're thinking about cost optimization inside of storage?
Oh, how the needle has moved on this subject so much in the last couple of years. So as a person with some history in data center co-location, the market has moved so strongly in the direction of more expensive rates. Whether you're a small business or a large business, right, your gear needs to go somewhere. And it's likely you're not going to be a data center constructor or an operator yourself, right? So you're either going to be paying monthly rent to AWS or you're going to be paying in the data center somewhere. And these costs have gone extremely high. Kilowatt pricing is up, you know, in some markets, it's up hundreds of percent over the last couple of years. Competition for space and power in markets is fierce. The data is firmly there that markets like Ashburn, Singapore are sub 1% vacancy. You know, and so when people think about the total cost, right, of that service, being mindful of the fact that if you want to do it yourself, you're going to have to bear all these costs in some component or another. You may or may not have the buying leverage with a colo provider to get a good rate, a good ramp, or any combination therein. You may not have the ability to get the kind of peering that you want. That is, you know, that's not always available in some markets. So what we bring is a strong buying presence to the colocation market, matched with a keen eye on the network of where the data is going, to give customers a simplified experience of saying, you know what, I want to be like right next to that compute farm in that market. And it's not AWS, it's not Azure, it's not GCP. And there's a very high probability we can provide that, right? And the customer doesn't have to worry about taking on all the challenge of trying to figure that out. And moreover, right, if you look at our pricing, it maintains its competitiveness, right? You know, people ask us all the time, like, how do you do it? It's like, well, if we told everybody, they'd all want to do it, right? So we keep some secrets to ourselves, right? Our CEO and founder, you know, has even shared with me that he was asked in past question and answer with customers, like, sometimes we're not even sure you're storing our data. Like, how do you do it for so little money? Like, what's the trick behind the curtain? It's like, no, trust us, we've got all your data. It's got 11 nines of durability and it's all there. But people, they're like, how do you do it? But if you try to do it yourself, like I said, it's very possible. It's expensive. It's hard. Finding additional growth space in Ashburn is really, really hard for certain types of buyers. But we take all the worry out of that. Just can rest assured knowing that your data is there. It's where we promised it would be. It's not getting moved around from place to place behind the curtain, and it's going to be there with 11 nines of durability.
Think about cost, right? And you're thinking about these areas and durability of the data. You know, one of the big areas, of course, is always concern around capacity, the read performance, the write speed. You know, how do you think about that? And maybe you have some examples where that was important.
You know, let's just come back to some of these new customers who want excessive amounts of network bandwidth, compared to prior years. That scales out across spinning disks at certain mathematical levels. You know, and we've got all the bench rating of the gear. We understand the capacity of what the gear can serialize. And so in the incumbent delivery model with, you know, 300,000 plus drives in production of mixed generations of spinning disk, it is scalable, right? But it is it's not particularly easy at this point of time. So we're increasingly looking at alternative technologies to try to integrate into the platform where we're using some form of flash-based storage or other types of technology to be able to give a different balance load between the sheer bulk storage versus the IOPS, right? I mean, the increasing size of drives is inevitably causing a widening in the gap between available IOPS versus the storage. And when you have a demanding work profile, again, like a person moving libraries for inference, those two numbers are very much misaligned. And yet you could end up with a whole bunch of stranded storage, or you could end up on the other side of things, you could end up flat out with IOPS starvation, which nobody wants, right? So we really are very careful about how we do augments, where we do them, and making sure that we're balancing out the raw available storage, right? Which I think worldwide now we're about 4.7 exabytes or so worldwide. And balancing that out with enough IOPS so people can come and get their data when they want, right? We will continue to look at emerging technologies and other things that can integrate into the platform to provide the best experience for our customers. You know, we're B2 Overdrive is an example of that, but we're not done yet. I can assure you in the skunk works of Backblaze, there's a lot of smart engineers that are working real hard on, you know, how we can integrate more performant infrastructure into the platform and or give greater performance through software, either vector.
So multiple times thus far, you've mentioned, you know, the key words here of AI and everything else that's going on in the world nowadays, you know, and as you guys, I'm sure, are dealing with more and more AI customers, as you've mentioned, you know, a lot of these people have massive storage needs, you know, for training their models and everything else. So are you seeing changes in storage patterns, you know, or is the traditional hot cold type of strategy still relevant for these customers, or what are you kind of seeing out there?
The pattern is strongly that, as I said before, people want to move vast quantities of data quickly. So how well developed our network is very important. Where are we? Who's across the hall from us? Where can we get PNIs with different, you know, ASNs? Where can we pick up something off of an IX? Where do we get into a spot where we have to drain traffic through IP transit, right? The combination of those factors matters, because it ultimately, it gives the customer the outcome they want, and also may give them the data security that they want. Some customers, we only want to transit traffic over PNI with you. We don't want our data going out over the public internet. Fine, we can accommodate that. The rate of churn of the data is also an occasional topic where a customer will say, all right, we're finished with that library, let's get rid of it, and let's bring on a whole new library of data. Now, processing petabytes and petabytes of deletion takes time. The customer wants to say, I'd like to load another whole library of data, right? So as I said before, that triangle of tension on the IOPS of read, writes, and deletes, you know, needs to be mindful of the customer use profile to say, you know, what's the average object size? How often are you going to be churning this data? And for some customers, you know, they are going to churn it, because once they're done doing that inferencing on the model, they're finished with it. They don't want to keep it around any longer. And they're happy to have us as a partner, but they may not be happy to just have a lot of stuff laying around in their digital junk drawer. So they want to get that stuff cleared out. The last thing that we're always keeping an eye on is the global real estate strategy, to make sure that we are where our customers want us to be, so that in the open cloud ecosystem, where there's lots of compute providers who aren't the hyperscalers, that we are in proximity to them, and that we can give customers a performant experience where it's either directly next to that compute or close enough so that the app stack is very happy with the results. And the AI space brings about interesting nuances, because we do see some of the processing happening in some very remote regions, which is not atypical. But they're not these, you know, they're not the traditional tier one markets in some cases, right? So, on a near weekly basis, we're always talking about where we could put a pin in the map and for whom. And would that be the right value for our customer? And like I said, you know, we're not talking about the typical markets. We're talking about some places that are, in some cases, a bit remote. But it's where they are. It's where our customers are. It's where they want to use their data. It's where they want their storage.
Yeah, you know, data sovereignty requirements, you know, becoming a bigger and bigger topic globally. How should engineers architect their systems to avoid expensive migrations potentially in the future?
That's a question with a twist on it. There is legislation in place in almost every country in the world that covers this topic, whether it's on the books or whether it's going to hit the books, that talks about individual citizen data privacy rights and the rights to their own data and or data sovereignty, you know, combinations of things. And knowing that atlas of legislation is a full-time job that we rely on strategic partners to help us navigate. But as an individual, it's a different experience. And there's some personal elements to it as well. I happen to be the user of the Google suite of offerings. I have my personal Google Drive. I haven't the faintest idea where all that content is. And I care, but I kind of don't care. As long as when I need it, it's there, and hopefully it all doesn't burn to the ground one day. Now, if I'm running a business where I've got sensitive information or something that is not up for that kind of liberty, you better know where your provider is putting your data, and you better know what they do with it. More importantly, you better know how they get it from place to place, right? You know, and when we designed our cluster in Toronto, data privacy and data sovereignty and security is taken extremely seriously there. And so we very, very carefully curated our network in market to ensure that Canadian customers would have their traffic ingress and egress through Canadian providers. And end to end, right? That data is not leaving the borders of Canada unless there's some kind of a very large catastrophe, which we don't want to imagine, right? But, you know, that's something that a certain cohort of buyers take very, very seriously. And you've got to challenge your provider, make sure that they can be honest with you and tell you, yeah, you know, I'm sorry, your data is kind of hairpinning through like Detroit or Chicago, but it eventually gets to Canada, right? You know, versus a cleaner statement where we know we live up to that warranty. Keeping on top of this legislation, though, you know, is a tough thing. It's a rapidly developing area. You know, Europe is leading the pace with this, but there's always adjustments and changes to things. We're appreciative in Backblaze that we've got a great team of legal team is great. And behind them, we've got a team of, you know, third party experts that always help us to be on top of what our obligations are as a provider, as an operator in the EU. What obligations do we have? When a customer says, I would like to terminate my service, we are required to evidence to them that we have no longer, we've destroyed their data and it's no longer here. Right. And we have to uplive that. We have to uphold that promise. America may get there one day, not quite there yet. Canada, way ahead of the pack. But, you know, it in the planning process, this is something that we talk about very early on. So we know what we're obligated to do and that we can develop the right solution around it so that we don't find ourselves on the wrong side of things.
So you mentioned, you know, the EU, and I know the EU has a lot of regulations now around green regulations and initiatives around sustainability and everything. How has that affected you guys, and what are you guys doing to help, you know, your customers with that?
So we're a happy happy customer of colocation providers. You know, so the operators obviously have the bigger burden and the bigger audit requirements per se. You know, we're happy to sign on with high efficiency providers. One example of that would be our data center in Stockton, California. It's got one of the most incredible PUEs ever. It's very, very green. It's very, very eco-friendly. There's other contrasting data centers that are not operating at that level, right? So when we do a site selection process, we want to make sure that, one, it's with a provider that's right for us, that's a good partner to us, and that their PUE and their operating profile fits what matches our personality, which is, you know, we want to make sure that we're getting a high quality, reliable experience from our co-location providers, but also having a green record is great. Being able to pass along a high efficiency PUE to a customer, it's great for business. Inefficient PUE, someone's paying for that, right? Whether we eat that cost or whether it has to be passed along. Now, more substantially, right, in certain jurisdictions in the EU, there are audits that the government enforces upon the colocation operator to make sure that the gear in that building is being operated in a power efficient way. You know, there's Amsterdam is an example of that, right, where they require the colocation provider to evidence that their own customers are operating their gear using, you know, the most efficient economical way of running that equipment. That's not something that existed 2 years ago. Over 2 years ago, run your gear however you want, you know, run it out to the rev limiter all day, every day. You know, that has changed now, right? So now, you know, we're participating in that effort, you know, as good citizens of the Amsterdam, to make sure that we know, okay, yes, we're operating our gear in an efficient power profile, and we're complying with the local regulations. But it is a rapidly developing area, probably driven too a bit because power is a constraint everywhere. I mean, data center operators can't get enough of it. It behooves them to make sure that their customers are using it efficiently and that there's a high level of PUE for the whole cohort of their customers, imagine.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's continuing to get more and more interesting as countries start focusing on these green initiatives and how do we report them? And it's a whole different level of capacity planning even than we were talking about earlier in the show about, you know, now not only do we need to make sure we have capacity, but that we're using that capacity in a green, efficient way, which is great. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you, Chris. Where can people learn more about Backblaze, the B2 storage, maybe sign up for a trial to give it a shot? And then how do they follow you if they're interested in what you had to say and I want to follow you on LinkedIn, et cetera?
Absolutely, Justin. Thank you. And Matthew, obviously come check out all of our collateral on backblaze.com. We've got a wonderfully entertaining YouTube channel. I personally find a lot of value in looking at a lot of the historic content that's out there. The company's a lot of fun. They produce some really engaging, fun content. Drop a line through any of the number of, in the website, you can obviously register interest and you'll get a contact from one of our sales folks to really help you get an understanding of what we are and who we are. We're actually actively out on the trade show tour. I can't remember where we're next. There's an upcoming AI show that we've got a speaking slot at. We go to NAB every year. We go to a lot of very well-known and well-trafficked trade shows. If you want to follow me, I'm kind of a LinkedIn guy. Look me up. Always happy to engage with customers or other interested parties there. Love it.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to having you on in the future and have a fantastic rest of your week.
Amazing. Matthew and Justin, thank you on behalf of Backblaze. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Chris, for joining us.
Visit thecloudbud.net to subscribe to the show, join our Slack channel, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also find information on reaching our audience through a CloudBud sponsorship opportunity. A big thank you to today's guest, and thank you for listening.